The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We are here. We are live at a Chicago hotel, the Marriott that charges a fair bit for wireless service, but doesn't have it doesn't have that great of a signal. So we moved from the seventh floor down to the third floor in hopes that the stream wouldn't cut out as much as it did yesterday. We were having trouble this morning when we were getting ready for the show. So basically, we grabbed all of our equipment, went downstairs just about 5 minutes ago, hurriedly set everything up here in another room, Sam's room, and we're off and running. So hopefully, you'll get a nice clear stream, even if the show is a little bit shorter than usual with the late start. If you do have technical difficulties, the recording is always crystal clear, and so you can go back and listen to the podcast at thetrumpet.com later on today. But for those of you that get up early and that listen to the live stream, hopefully the next 40, 45 minutes will be uninterrupted. We're in Chicago for the PAC, as many of you know. Sunday night, we had 191 in attendance. And last night, for the second evening, we had 118 in attendance. 70 of them were non-members. So we had a really great night again. I think we went until 10:30 or so, 10:45, talking to everybody after the fact. So it was a later night than Sunday night. And some really good feedback. I talked about the subject of repentance, and kind of along the lines of the same theme we've been emphasizing in many of these cities, to act on this knowledge, to be a doer of God's word and not a hearer only. But I put more of a focus on repentance last night, and like I say, I think a lot of people that came up afterwards seemed like they were really impacted in a positive way by some of those scriptures that we covered. So we'll have we actually have a mega montage prepared for you. Not a MAGA montage, but a mega montage. Sam was busy again last night. He's got some feedback from some of those who attended the PAC. I think he also has some interviews with Victor Vigil and Mr. Cal Culpepper, the regional director over the Northeast. So they've been, let's see, we were together in New York City. We were together in Detroit and then Cincinnati a few weeks ago. And then, of course, here in Chicago. And then both Mr. Vigil and Mr. Culpepper will be traveling with us later today down to Indianapolis. So his region, Mr. Culpepper's region, really has been impacted quite a lot by the numerous PACs that we've had in the Northeast over the past 3 months. So you can look forward to Sam's interview with both of those men as he asks them about just the impact that these PACs have had on some of the congregations. Well, earlier this month, we talked about some of the lessons from World War II, 80 years on from Germany's invasion of Poland. And we sometimes forget the other invasion of Poland that came from the opposite direction. Today, September 17th, is the day that Poland was invaded by Russia. An estimated 800,000 Soviet troops poured into Little Poland as part of this this Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, basically the decision of Germany and Russia going into World War II to carve up Poland. Poland, of course, caught right in the middle. This is from an article, The Forgotten Second Invasion of Poland. It says this second invasion is too often overlooked. In 2014, the article says, then U.S. President Barack Obama had the dubious distinction of announcing a plan to abandon the development of a missile defense system in Eastern Europe on the 75th anniversary of the Soviet invasion of Poland. I don't think he was aware of that, but it was on September the 17th back in 2014 when Mr. Obama made that, as it says here, that dubious announcement. But it says here some 13.5 million Poles would be absorbed into the USSR as a result of the invasion following pro forma plebiscite condoning Moscow's annexation. And it says in parentheses, sound familiar? This is this was routine back in the 1930s for some of the Allied nations that just stepped aside and let Russia, let Germany commit these violent acts of aggression. It says Soviet authorities deported thousands of Poles further east to Siberia on trumped up charges. It says on March 5th, 1940, the Soviet Politburo approved a plan to execute some 22,000 Polish prisoners, mostly soldiers, who were massacred at a number of secret locations in Poland, most notably within the Katyn Forest between April and May of 1940. So they were just, the Polish people, just massacred from both sides. Coming in from Germany, September 1st, 1939, and then a couple of weeks later, 2.5 weeks later, September 17th, 1939, when Russia invaded Poland from the east. So some wonderful, well, not wonderful, but some powerful lessons that we don't want to soon forget from 1939. And I won't take you back to some of those lessons we discussed on this program a couple of weeks ago, but I thought it was an important anniversary to draw some attention to here at the start. Yesterday we talked about the drone attack from Iran. Last night, Brent Noctegal, he had the trumpet brief, and he pointed out how that Iran just pushed us, the world that is, one step closer to war. As Brent said in his brief, no one denies that Iran was behind the audacious attack. The big question is whether the attack came from Iran's mainland or one of its proxies. And as Brent points out, if it comes from one of the proxies, then you can, you know, you can have a strike in response, some kind of response. But when it comes direct from Iran, that makes it a little bit more tricky for the United States, for Saudi Arabia, because this is something that the U.S., from the very beginning, since 9/11, the U.S. has refused to do. That is, to actually attack the head of the snake directly. Brent says here, the evidence now points to the fact that it came from Iran's mainland. So here is the United States now and Saudi Arabia in the difficult position of, well, are they going to do something, or are they going to appear to be very weak and have no response? Richard, in his news stack this morning, said that there's not a lot of news today. We're only a few days removed from the attack, but there's not a lot of news about what the U.S. or Saudi Arabia are prepared to do in response, which makes you wonder if there will be any kind of response. President Trump has said, I'm somebody that would like not to have war. He said the other day, no, I don't want war with anybody, but we're prepared more than anyone. So in the soundbite, I didn't bring it with me, but he talked about how strong the United States is, how much, you know, we have in the form of armaments and such. But at the same time, he's also had a track record, a relatively short one at that, but a track record of not wanting to initiate conflict. George Friedman pointed out that the attack does put the U.S. and Saudi Arabia in a very difficult position. He said the U.S. cannot ignore the attack as the great military power in the anti-Iran coalition. It is the de facto security guarantor. But if it strikes, it invites a response from the Iranians and resistance from its allies. If it does not strike, it weakens the foundations of the anti-Iran alliance and strengthens Iran. He says that the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has recently alluded to the possibility that the U.S. was open to negotiations. The Iranians may have seen this attack as an important negotiating point. Friedman says finally, it is difficult to see how the U.S. can respond without risking more attacks on Saudi Arabia. It is likewise difficult to see how the U.S. can avoid striking without losing the alliance's confidence. So a very difficult position that the U.S. is currently in, as Iran, as Brent pointed out yesterday, pushes the world one step closer to war. Well, as an aside here, you've got Germany pushing for its country or its nation to lift its export ban on Saudi Arabia following this attack. Germany stepping forward to try to help Saudi Arabia more. And of course, this is significant because of the Psalm 83 alliance, these two camps in the Middle East, and how that half of them or one camp's going to side with Germany when it's all said and done. It's not a huge step forward, but lifting an export ban, it does just inch Germany closer to Saudi Arabia. It puts Germany in a position where they're wanting to help arm Saudi Arabia, which, as Richard pointed out this morning, would be an important step for that prophesied alliance. But coming back to the United States, here again, there still is quite a lot of weakness on display when you look across the world. But of course, when you just zero in on the United States at home, there is some strength being projected from this current administration. Victor Davis Hanson has a piece at American Greatness about, the way that they're attacking the president now, now that the Mueller report has turned out to be a big flop. He says the post-Mueller media narrative is weariness and exhaustion with President Trump's tweets, his cul-de-sac Sharpie controversy, his ideas about buying Greenland, his unorthodox art-of-the-deal foreign policy that resulted in a plan to talk to Taliban leaders in the United States, and his firing of arch-conservative John Bolton. So this is the new approach. This is the new strategy we've mentioned before. Now they're shifting gears. The New York Times is shifting gears over to racism. Everything's racist. President Trump, by the way, he was in New Mexico. There were headlines yesterday where he's in New Mexico trying to swing that state over to the Republican camp. But he's there for another rally yesterday, and he did a pretty good job of just summarizing the radical left's strategy in coming after him. This is clip one.
How about these phony Democrats? They started with Russia, Russia, Russia. That turned out to be a fraud. Then they went to race. Do you believe that one, race? I'm the least racist person in this room. Then they went to recession. There's going to be a recession. Oh, please let there be a recession, please. Because we have a better chance of defeating him if there's a recession. And unfortunately, the stock market's only a few points from its all-time high, which we've broken on, I think it's well over 100 times. We broke the all-time record. And now they have a new one. That I'm enriching myself. Let me tell you, by doing this and taking this particular job, which I love, it will cost me billions and billions of dollars. But if somebody from the Middle East that I never saw before comes in and stays at one of my hotels for an evening and pays $439, emoluments. Nobody ever heard the word emolument before. Emolument. Nobody ever heard that word. Emolument. He's enriching himself.
That's President Trump from yesterday, having a little fun with his detractors once again, pulling in $439 from one of his hotel rooms. Victor Davis Hanson, just in speaking about some of the successes he's had domestically, he said the August jobs report unexpectedly reminds us that never have so many Americans been at work. The 3.7% unemployment rate continues to be the lowest peacetime unemployment figure in 50 years. Hanson says black and Hispanic unemployment remain at record lows. Workers' wages continue to rise. Talk of recession is belied by low interest, low inflation, low unemployment, and a strong stock market. He says the result is that millions of Americans enjoy far better lives than they had in 2016. A lot of people are benefiting. And we talked yesterday on the program how that in the short term, well, that's prophesied. But the unemployment figure, lowest in 50 years, record lows for minorities, for the Black and Hispanic communities. Yesterday at the White House, the president was asked about some of the initiatives he has now for some of America's bigger cities, which are really struggling. And this is what he had to say. Clip two.
Well, I think what I've done for the inner cities is more than any president has done for a long time. We've created opportunity zones. In fact, I did that with Tim Scott, who you know very well, who's, I think, a tremendous guy. It was his initiative, and he came to see me. They're having a tremendously positive impact on the inner cities, including Baltimore, including a lot of other cities that you wouldn't necessarily think. Oakland, California, is an example. We're having tremendous success in the inner cities because of the opportunity zones. Criminal justice reform, I was the one that got it. Nobody else. I mean, we had people that helped, but a group of extremely liberal Democrats came to the office and they said, we cannot get it. President Obama was unable to get it, as you know. President Bush, they were all unable to get it, and I got it.
That's President Trump yesterday talking about some of the work he's done for cities like Oakland. And can you imagine if you think about all the trouble, in even here in Chicago, with violence and such, Baltimore, and then the homelessness crisis out in the West Coast, Portland, Sacramento, Los Angeles. If he starts intervening there and works to clean up some of these cities that have been governed by left-wing liberals for decades, well, you can just add that to the list of accomplishments here at home. Victor Davis Hanson went on to say in his piece, he's also waging a 360-degree, 24/7 war against a corrupt media, an assessment that most in the past accepted, but were too fearful of confronting. They all knew it, President Bush and others like him, they knew that they were going against a radical left-wing media, but they would not stand up to it. They would not confront it. It says, before Trump, CNN, despite its overt biases, was still considered a legitimate news organization. After Trump, it is little more than the airport lounge equivalent of Muzak. I'm not familiar with that. I should have looked that up before I got here. But that's Victor Davis Hanson saying just how useless, and they're being exposed. That's the thing. Ditto the New York Times and the Washington Post. It says they're descending into blogs whose reason for being has been reduced to destroying Trump, a frenzy in which the Times stooped to anti-Semitism and recruiting racists to their editorial board to publishing fake news. President Trump yesterday, by the way, he talked about how that those individuals at the New York Times responsible for this latest attack on Brett Kavanaugh, that they should be fired. So he's out there every day, as Hanson brings out, waging the 360-degree, 24/7 war against a corrupt media. And that's what it is. It's corrupt through and through. The other day, the president talked about what we're going against, the way he put it, what he's going up against as he prepares for the re-election of 2020. Here's clip three.
We've done things that I don't think any administration has even come close in the first 2.5 years. We have done things that very, very few have even thought about doing. But we also need to prepare for the coming fight, because the traditions and beliefs that have made the American dream possible are under attack like never before.
The traditions and beliefs that made the American dream possible, they've come under attack like never before. And to his credit, as Victor Davis Hanson points out, he's waging a war against this corruption. So as I say, there's not as much strength being projected abroad, but here at home, he certainly is exposing so much of this evil. And of course, we're probably days away from getting the report on the FISA abuses, which is only going to open up more in the way of exposure as to what's been happening here these past 3 or 4 years. Just to conclude here in Victor Davis Hanson's piece, he says Trump's popularity rating may be for now frozen between 43-44%, but even if accurately calibrated by polls, and I think some have suggested that the polls don't even accurately reflect his true popularity, it says it's still not yet Bush's 33% when he left office. And Hanson points out how that the last year that Bush had in office, it was really a pretty good year for him. And it says here that Bush, contrary to popular invective, had a decent last year. He was quiet and philosophical, not the Texas combative in his final 12 months. So he just kind of retreated a little bit in that last year, and still his popularity was down in the basement, 33%. Well, President Trump's in the mid-40s. I think I saw a poll the other day that even said it was closer to 50%. This last article here from Real Clear, the reason I guess we took note of it is there's a reference to a biblical passage, Why Trump Will Win, The Evidence of Things Unseen. And this author here says the New Testament tells us that faith is the evidence of things unseen. And then he says, if that is true in politics, then the faith of Trump's supporters that he will be reelected is based on what was unseen and unheard on the Democrat debate stage in Houston last week, namely the thriving economy and the many other accomplishments of this administration. So faith in Donald Trump, I think that pretty much sums up the mindset of his many supporters here in this Jeroboam end. When we come back, we'll lead into the mega montage. You've got feedback from the Chicago Pack, and you've got some interviews coming up too with our ministers in this Northeast region. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can submit feedback to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
So we're finishing up our stay here in Chicago, putting the finishing touches on a successful PAC event, two nights. The first evening, I spoke about taking God's tide at the flood, To paraphrase what Shakespeare wrote in Julius Caesar, this is something my father has repeatedly drawn attention to in recent weeks in meetings, even in a message that he gave a couple of weeks ago. And I use that same quote from Shakespeare to really encourage our trumpet readers to act on this knowledge and to get behind the momentum of this work, God's church in these last days. And then last night, as I said at the top of the show, I focused more on repentance and bringing forth the fruits of repentance, as Jesus said there in Matthew 3. And so the emphasis through and through, and I used some examples from the Bible, Cain and Esau, and how that they sorrowed, but that sorrow did not lead to a change in behavior. So that's just a little bit of a synopsis of the messages that we've had from the past two nights. To conclude with on today's show, we've got some feedback from some of those who attended the PAC, and then also, as I say, Sam's interviews with Mr. Vigil and Mr. Culpepper.
Hi, my name is Larry. I've been a trumpet subscriber. I don't know, it's been a few years. I don't remember exactly. Sorry. this is my second pack. The last pack I've been to was in 2017, right?
Yeah, Chicago.
Yeah, it was here in the same one. That's when I met Mr. Gerald Fleury.
Great.
And it was great. I even got his autograph in the Overcomer book.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. And he's a tall guy. He's taller than me. So I was like, oh, man, he's a big, tall guy, and his son's bigger, too. He's a big dude, too.
Have you spoken to Mr. Stephen Fleury?
Yeah, I spoke to him yesterday, and I want to talk to him again today. Maybe get a picture, maybe get another autograph of him, too, you know? And, what he was saying is, you know, spot on. It's been just like last night, and then even from a couple years ago, it's been making a really big impression on my mind, you know? And I know I read an article, I believe Mr. Stephen Fleury wrote it, something about when God works on your mind, there's like a pressure and like there's like urgency and stuff, and it's like I gotta do something, just do it, you know, and then just, you know, work on getting rid of bad habits, overcoming, praying more. I mean, really being, you know, real in prayer, you know, letting them know how you feel, and then asking for help where you need it the most, you know, and grab the Bible, just read, you know.
Hi, my name is Sylvia Alvarez, and I found the Philadelphia Church of God through my husband. That's how I started to get interested, and then I started reading some of his books because he used to lay them around. I found one in his car, actually, when we were dating. And so it was very interesting to find out who Herbert W. Armstrong was. And ever since, I've been, it's been 6 years. We've been 6 years married, too. And I've been in connection with the church, even if it's been reading it. I've been hearing it from day one since the Trumpet Daily radio shows and all the other radio broadcasts out there, like the Trumpet booklet, Living by Every Word, the Best Literature, since they all started. Yeah, I follow them, and you know, the Trumpet Live, I get to sit down at work. And basically, that's what I do. I go to work and I plug in my headphones as soon as I get there, just to listen to the best word of God, which comes from the trumpet.
And you were here in 2017?
Yes, I was. I was here since 2017, and I met Mr. Gerald Fleury first, and now today, his son, Stephen Fleury.
Good.
Okay, my name is Christos Primbas, the Greek. Everyone knows me by that. It's easier for them to remember me by, especially because of the first name. I've been here with the PAC from 2017. I have met Mr. Fleury, Mr. Gerald Fleury, now Mr. Stephen Fleury. I am a possible prospect that Mr. Culpepper is working with, trying to become a member of the Philadelphia Church of God. and everyone's been very like helpful and hopeful for me, and they're Mr. Culpepper still working with me, and everyone's rooting me on.
I'm here with preaching elder Mr. Victor Vigil, and he's going to give us a bit of a summary on what goes into setting up some of the PACs in his region.
On our side of planning for a PAC, we wait for headquarters to pick the city, pick the venue, pick the date. Once all of that's arranged through headquarters, then Mr. Culpepper gets involved on our end to arrange all of the volunteers who come out and help. There's a lot of different responsibilities. It's a lot like a Feast of Tabernacles at our church, where we have a hospitality department that handles the literature tables, the Bible study sign-up, registration. We have a department that handles the auditorium setup and maintenance, setting up chairs and arranging ushers to help people find seats. And then we have other departments as well. And so a large part of what we do is organize the church members to volunteer for those various responsibilities. We assign them ahead of time. We arrange for an organization meeting before the PAC. And as far as my responsibilities, a neat part of one of the jobs that I've been able to help out is transportation. So a lot of times Mr. Culpepper and the other ministers and some brethren as well will help out transportation, making sure that the staff flying in from headquarters can make it to the hotel, that they're all set for the responsibilities that they need to fulfill. And so that's largely what we're doing, planning the PAC. But as far as a minister, a large part of the work actually comes after the personal appearance campaigns are over as well. We have the follow-up Bible studies. Again, it's typically the regional director that conducts most of those follow-up Bible studies. Since we've had such a blitz of them lately, it's been giving an opportunity for Mr. Nice and I to do some of that as well. So there's a lot of work that goes into the follow-up Bible studies, finding the venues for that, arranging the volunteers for that, and then also interacting with the subscribers, those who are interested in following through at those Bible studies. Now, not everybody who wants to pursue membership goes to the Bible studies, and so we also come away with a list of names and numbers of people we want to be contacting. So besides organizing and planning follow-up Bible studies, we're also, in the meantime, calling all of those people, getting into contact with them, doing visits with those who are wanting a visit. And so that's where a lot of the work's done, the follow-up with the subscribers who are wanting to move forward. And that's actually a very exciting part. And you know, a lot goes into it. Mr. Stephen Fleury coming out and speaking, all the headquarters staff, there's a lot that's invested into these personal appearance campaigns. And that's just extra motivation for us, I think, to really take advantage of that afterwards with the follow-up Bible studies, with the phone calls and the visits, because we know it's a unique opportunity and we don't want to let that opportunity pass without giving it our all to support what's being done from headquarters.
So, ride the tide.
That's right, ride the tide.
I am here with the regional director of the Northeast, Mr. Kyle Culpepper. He's going to give us a brief update on the impact of the personal appearance campaigns in his region. Mr. Culpepper?
Yes. Nice to talk with you, Sam. It's been very interesting. We just completed our second night with the Chicago personal appearance campaign. It was very active tonight. It was last night. And something that we're noticing, it seems like we get a different group. We had different people in, not all of them, but there was enough that a couple of us noticed that there's a different group that sort of came tonight than the first night. Yeah. And I'm not quite sure what that dynamic is about. I don't know if they just couldn't come out on Sunday, but I met several new people on Monday night that I did not on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And they seem very interested. I know I had last night, between myself and Mr. Vigil, we had 11 people come up to us as the minister saying, I want contact. And tonight, I'm reaching for my book because tonight I've got five more. So it's just interesting how they're responding and how they seem to be responding on different nights in different ways.
Yeah.
And I had somebody else mention that tonight it was just very busy. People were really very interested. So I know at least four new people tonight that I had not. That's all the time I had to get around. But they are very interested in coming. It's also meeting people from the Chicago Pack from 2 years ago. I'm really amazed. I bet you I've talked to, well, I was talking to a couple tonight that I spoke with 2 years ago. And so out of total, I probably have met and talked to five or six from 2 years ago. And they want me to move forward. They want to move forward towards acting on what they're hearing. But I do see this, Sam. I do see that it's Satan really knows how to grab on to people so that they don't quite break out of the inertia spiritually. Some of them come and they're very determined and they're going to push through. Other ones, it's just like you and me. If we've got problems in our life, you know, it takes a lot maybe to overcome the inertia to start overcoming and changing. And they're sort of, some of these folks are like that. It's taking something like Mr. Stephen Fleury speaking tonight was just wonderful. He's really just putting it out there and trying to get them motivated to step out, to step forward. And boy, that's just exactly what they need. And I see that at all of them. New York was that way. Detroit, Cincinnati. Now we're in Chicago. We'll be in Indianapolis tomorrow night. I'm sure it's the same there. You know, back in June, it was interesting. I was reading in the autobiography, and it was the section where Mr. Armstrong's still in the Northwest. And he was talking about the campaigns he was having. He was talking about growth in the church. And he made the comment that he had prayed to God that as much as God was willing to use him to help him expand the work. And I thought, that really grabbed me. And it was interesting because that was on my mind. And that week I found out we were going to have seven campaigns in this region. And two of them got postponed, which I think was wise. But five of them we're doing. And you know what? We're expanding God's family empire. That's what we're doing. And I tell you, we're going to the lambs, and the lambs are responding. A lot of them are just coming out of terrible backgrounds, and they want to break loose, if I can say it. They want a new life. They want hope. And you know what? But I also see the sheep, the people, the brethren. It galvanizes them.
Yeah, you mentioned about that a little bit earlier. I was just wondering what sort of impact all of these campaigns have had on the brethren in the region, because you've had quite a few up here now. Just what sort of impact has that had as far as helping the congregations and building unity and their excitement as well? What sort of things have you observed in that regard?
I think it helps build their vision of what the work is about, because I say that because they're going out. They don't counsel like a minister does, but they are meeting new people the way the ministry meets new people. And the light in their eye, you know, how they are beaming with God's Spirit as they meet someone that's on the outside, if I can say that, wanting to come in. I can really see that. That really helps him to have more of a grasp what the commission. I mean, that's just on the tip of the spear of the commission, going to the world, taking the gospel to the world, and they're seeing it up close and personal. So I think that has a tremendous impact on them.
Obviously, a lot of work goes into preparing these campaigns. You and Mr. Vigil and Mr. Nice get your directives from headquarters, and there's a lot of prep work in there, but I was just wondering, you know, how much work follows the campaigns? You obviously travel a lot and you're a little short-staffed with driving around, doing those follow-up Bible studies and maintaining contact with people. How much, or what's the workload like that follows the personal appearance campaign for you and Mr. Vigil and Mr. Nice?
I would say the pack really is the beginning.
Yeah.
There are a few that will come along very quickly. those are the ones that we, the ministry, has had contact with prior to the PAC. And the PAC sort of pushes them over to break that inertia we were talking about and to step forward and say, I'd like to do something. Those are a few. The one, two, three kind of a thing. By way and afar, the process starts with the brethren, with these lambs, and that can go. It just depends on the individual. Some are going to move on this quicker than others. Some are going to respond quicker than others. So it could go, you know, several months, 6 months, a year kind of a thing, depending on the individual. And then I do think that we're sowing seeds for a longer term, because I know in New York, two of the people that we, out of the four we invited, we had visited with 13 years ago. Wow. And they had not forgotten about it. Their life wasn't quite right. I think God was working on them when this pack came up, this summer's pack came to New York. I saw that in Chicago tonight. It's the same thing. People that have coming to the PAC 2 years ago, and now they're wanting to step forward because they know, they inherently know what Mrs. Stephen Fleury is saying is correct, that they could be here 2 years from now, like he said tonight. And if they don't do something with this, they could lose it. And time's clicking along. So I just think it really gets down to the individual. There can be, you know, if people really applying themselves with prayer and study and of course now we want them to be familiar with Mystery of the Ages and Malachi's message. Some of them have read those two books, some of them have not. And of course, if they really apply themselves and get the gist of that, and they're doing the basics, if I can say that, they're keeping the Sabbath and these kind of things, it can actually move along pretty quickly. But you're asking a general question, so some are going to move on like that a little quickly, and other ones will take a little longer time.
Yeah. I talked to a few that were at the PAC in 2017 here in Chicago, and they became members a year later, and now they're here as brethren, and that's neat to see. But not everyone moves along that quickly. Like you said, some have come to the PAC back in 2006 and are still around, so
that's right.
Everyone's on a different course there. One thing that I noticed that you mentioned before the PAC meeting was that you started having a sign-up sheet at the back table for people who didn't have time to speak with a minister. Obviously, there are hundreds of people there, and there are only so many ministers, so you're obviously very busy. So you started implementing this sign-up sheet for people that didn't have a chance to talk to a minister, and you're going to follow up based on the information they leave on that sign-up sheet. So maybe you could just explain a little bit more about how that idea came about and what the responses have been like with that new sign-up sheet.
You know, I felt like I was a little slow in picking up on that because I had noticed during the summer that I'd be talking to people. I could see several would be lined up to speak. But the next thing I would notice, I'm talking to this whoever, and they would walk out the door. And I thought, wow, you know, we didn't connect. And it dawned on me, I said, well, maybe they'd be willing to sign a sheet if they have to leave early, and just this sheet would be basically saying that, yes, I do want contact with the ministry. Here's my name and here's my phone number. And I ran that idea by Mr. Fleury, actually, and he liked that, so we started doing it. And you know what? Much to my surprise, it's been working better than I even expected, because I think last night we had 12 people sign that list, and I didn't look at the list. We got four or five tonight that have signed the list, giving us their name and numbers, saying we want contact. Mm-hmm. And so, wow. So look, you only have so much time after the pack. And if people are talking to you and you get engaged in a conversation, even if you got several ministers there, you can miss other ones. And I think the idea was just to give someone an opportunity or an outlet to say, well, I'm sorry I missed you. I want contact. Here's my name and number. Give me a call. And they are using it. And it's working very well.
Yeah, it's one thing that another thing I noticed just with these packs here in Chicago is how proactive you guys are in following up quickly and really going after people that show any sort of interest. So I just think that's a really neat way to keep up with that. That's about all I've got. Do you have any parting remarks for everyone?
Well, going after them is what it's about, because I do feel like, I don't know if the right term is shelf life, but I sort of do kind of think it's sort of like that, that they leave, they're on fire, they're zealous, but it can wane in a hurry, because, as I said, even in the church we know we fight ourselves and the world and Satan, and so are these lambs. But they're not being fed in the church, and they're not converted yet. And so it does seem like it's as quickly as possible getting to them while the fire is still there is very important. So that's why we try to get to them as quickly as we can.